Welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
There. I did it the way I was supposed to.
Yeah.
And,
very good.
You can find everything you would like to know about our show at wethepeopleradio.us. And I really want to highlight the archives. They're extremely helpful. Anything we talk about on the show, publications that our guests have written, books that they've written, articles about them in the news, we always link all that stuff up on a page for each program, along with a commercial-free archive that our friend Robert Exter does for us. Thanks for that, Robert.
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
So he cuts out our salutes to capitalism, and that way it takes you less time to listen, which is great. So this is one of those programs that is a topic that we hear about a lot. And for some reason, it's usually discussed very briefly. And I think most people that it doesn't affect directly, I hate to say it, but maybe don't think about it at all. So today's going to be about anti-Semitism.
And I think unchecked, it will affect you directly.
Oh, most definitely will. Yeah. And our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small, will explain that to you. But honestly, I think most people hear that and they think, well, I'm not Jewish. It doesn't matter. So today we will be explaining to you why it does matter. So just in case you thought Dr. Charles Asher Small was not qualified, let's see, his bio is 2.5 pages long. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, although it is posted, and it's impressive. He's the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. And it's abbreviated, obviously, or captioned as ISGAP. So the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy is ISGAP, and we'll be referring to that a lot today. So when you hear that, that's what we're talking about. I kind of cherry-picked through his resume things that I thought were, I mean, I actually was all really interesting. I started highlighting everything, and it's like, okay, that wasn't what I was.
We're going to have to do this in segments.
I wasn't really planning on highlighting all of it. So he was the founding director, and he convened groundbreaking academic seminar series, conferences, and programming in the emerging field of contemporary anti-Semitism studies at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Stanford, Fordham, McGill, University of Miami, University in Rome, the Sorbonne in Paris, in France. He's everywhere. He's literally everywhere. And where was my list of all the places? Here we go. He's lectured throughout the world as an expert scholar on anti-Semitism, of course. He was a visiting professor at McGill, at Cape Town University, at La Sapienza in Rome, University of Lithuania. He's been a guest scholar and lectured in hundreds of universities around the world, addressed European Parliament, the United Nations, the Israeli Knesset, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It just literally goes on and on, but my favorite part of his whole bio is just this little last sentence here of one paragraph. He says he's also served as a consultant and policy advisor in North America, Europe, South Africa, and the Middle East.
Was that all?
When they list your places by country.
Yeah.
It's so much faster, too. So anyway, really an interesting man. And I met him down at the Israeli consulate, and I had to go get on BART. So we were walking down the street and talking, and I thought, gosh, you know, there should be so many more people who heard just the little short, maybe 15-minute thing he presented. So we hatched a radio program on the streets of San Francisco, fearing for our lives, of course.
Yeah. And watching where you're walking.
Before the drug addicts came and the poop overtook us. He was trapped there for a period of time, but I believe he's back home now. Dr. Small, are you in there?
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Dr. Good Small. Thanks for being on today.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here with you.
Are you still trapped in San Francisco, or did you get to escape and go back home?
No, I'm still in San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. Another 6 weeks or so.
Oh, I don't know. In my head, I thought you had said you got to go home in June, so I thought, I didn't ask him the beginning, the end, the middle. 6 weeks. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
You do, too. I don't know. It's not really a wild and woolly city. Were you the one they chased with hypodermic needles?
Yeah, that was one of my memorable experiences here.
Because I have another guy, he's with the National Parks Service, and he got transferred there and was so horrified, he actually relocated his family to Vancouver, Washington, and he's just going to commute.
Yeah.
Decided it was just better overall. Oh, my gosh. So We have, I mean, we've looked at so much of your information. I should tell people that if they go to charlesashersmall.com, spelled just like it sounds, there's a tremendous amount of information there. And also isgap.org, I-S-G-A-P, like Paul, .org. Huge amounts of information, and a lot of your lectures and papers are there for reference for people.
Also, too, I might add, I watched several of your seminars and lectures on YouTube. If you type in his name on YouTube, a whole bunch of stuff will come up, and you can actually sit and watch his talks.
You're actually one of those guys who can search on the internet and not a whole bunch of bad stuff comes up. So, good for you.
Yeah. Not yet. No kidding.
Well, you spend a tremendous amount of time working in the with academic people to try to educate them on what you call modern anti-Semitism. I don't know how you want to start this, but let's just presume people really haven't given this any thought and kind of go from that point.
Right. So one of the things that we do at ISGAP, so we're a nonprofit research center, and we're a 501c3 in the United States. And we're a nonprofit organization in Canada and Europe as well. And what we do, we start off by doing seminars and research on contemporary anti-Semitism. And what we started to do, we realized that there weren't any courses on the contemporary challenges of anti-Semitism. So we started actually, we developed a program at Oxford University where we bring professors, many from the United States, and we actually train them on how to create courses for credits at their home university. And there's really, I guess there's a blind spot on contemporary issues, because I think we've been taught, over the last generation or two, that anti-Semitism was something that was horrible that happened in the past,
yep,
that we somehow overcame it. And what we realize is that, you know, issues are reemerging in a powerful way, and we feel that anti-Semitism is not really a Jewish issue or an issue for Israelis, but it's an issue for anybody who cares about democracy and basic notions of citizenship. And as Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and survivor of the Holocaust, always taught, was that when, you know, that anti-Semitism begins with Jews, but it never ends with Jews. And I think that was one of his most important lessons, that once this form of hatred is unleashed on society, it knows no boundaries. And other groups and other peoples are attacked as well.
See, and that's, I think, the part that people don't, I'm not sure, you know, people really understand that or give that much thought.
Well, and also, I was listening to one of your lectures, and you spoke about I don't know if you were starting at the beginning or what, but there were basically three types of anti-Semitism, and now the basically a fourth emerging now with the contemporary anti-Semitism. But maybe you could briefly hit on those three types that I think people are somewhat familiar with.
Okay, sure. So, yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. So,
good job, Bill.
In my presentations and in my work, I basically argue there are three types of anti-Semitism, or anti-Semitisms with an S, plural. And what makes anti-Semitism unique is its inherent genocidal tendency. So other forms of discrimination or hatreds, racism, sexism, can cause a lot of damage, and it could be quite horrific. But there's something inherent in anti-Semitism that is genocidal, and I'll explain. So there's basically three phases of anti-Semitism. The first phase, or the dominant phase, when the dominant way of perceiving reality was through the lens of religion. At many points in time, not throughout in entire histories, but at many points in time, there was a Christian teaching that that the Jewish people didn't accept the Christian notion of the Messiah. So there was a belief that they were, quote-unquote, blinded by evil, and that they could not have personal redemption. So that's bad in and of itself. A group of people can't have personal redemption or be at one with God. But what made anti-Semitism sort of inherently genocidal is that people said that global redemption or world redemption would never happen until the quote-unquote stubborn Jews would accept the Christian notion of the Messiah. So this resulted in forced conversions, pogroms, groups of Jewish communities being exiled from various spaces over time. And then when the dominant view of the world shifted from religion to science and biology and basically notions of biologically determined groups like racial groups and ethnic groups, the Jews were perceived as being the wrong race and the wrong people. And in fact, people started saying things and circulating tropes and anti-Semitic tropes that Jews were destroying the purity of the white so-called Aryan race or the white nation.
Then it all goes down the drain. Hang on to that thought, Dr. Schmal. We'll be right back in 2 minutes.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
And we're back. You're listening to We the People. We are here with Dr. Charles Asher Schmal. He is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, or ISGAP for short. Okay, go back to the big four.
Okay, so I was speaking about kind of Christian forms of discrimination over the centuries, mainly in Europe. And then I started to discuss the sort of when the dominant perspective of perceiving reality shifted from religion to science and biologically determined groups, the Jews were perceived mainly in Europe as being of a different so-called race. And we have to remember that the social sciences, the science, the theology at the time, people really believed in the innate differences of different characteristics that each so-called race had. And the Jews were perceived as an impure race, poisoning the purity of the white Aryan race. So unlike the time of Christianity, where Jews were at times offered the ability to convert or forcibly convert, people believed that race was somehow innate and you can't escape your so-called race or biologically determined group. So there was no escape for the Jews. And this type of racist anti-Semitism basically culminates in the Holocaust and the extermination of the Jewish people. Now, after the Holocaust, you can make the argument that there was, a honeymoon period. There was a time when sort of Nazi, fascist, and racist forms of anti-Semitism were no longer, thankfully, acceptable in the United States, in Europe. People sort of learned, in quotations, the lessons of the Holocaust. But what's happening today is sort of a new form of, or a contemporary form of anti-Semitism, which is focused on the demonization of who Jews are as a people. So the old forms of Christian anti-Semitism or racist anti-Semitism, if you were working in a good liberal institution at a good university or in the media of record, and you espoused those old types of anti-Semitisms, I think that you would be ostracized and perhaps your career could even come to an end if you articulated those unpopular beliefs and those damaging beliefs. But today, to demonize and to delegitimize who Jews are as a people, I would argue in those liberal, progressive institutions, you're not only not ostracized, but I think you're actually, you're promoted.
I think so, too. You see that all the time. Yeah. It's like, how are they getting away with all this stuff?
Exactly. So now the new anti-Semitism is the delegitimization and demonization of Israel as, if you look at the media, as a so-called apartheid state, which I think is a a travesty against the South African people who survived apartheid, that Israel is a racist state, a colonial state, a pinkwashing state. In other words, any epithet you can have against Israel is perfectly acceptable, and that's thanks to the sort of intellectual and political moment that we're living in this sort of postmodern, anti-Western, anti-American, anti-Israel moment. And I think that as Israel becomes, you know, every possible epithet is being used against Israel, many people thought that was just a problem for the Israelis. But we can see that those espousing those type of views are also attacking Jewish communities in Europe and now even in the United States. So if Israel is a racist, fascist, apartheid, colonial, pinkwashing, you name it, entity, well, then Jewish people going to pray on Sabbath or Jewish students going to, Jewish organizations at universities are now being perceived in a very negative light. So anti-Semitism is not just contained to Israel, but it's being exported around Europe and North America. And it's being exported by people on the radical, we call them the radical green or political Islamists. And I'm not speaking about Islam or Muslims, but I'm speaking about political Islam that cannot be allow anybody to be equal to a practicing Muslim. And the Jewish people through the State of Israel are the only non-Muslims in that part of the world who have self-determination. And it's a democracy. So Jews and Muslims and Christians, women, and other gendered identities, minorities, are all equal under the law in that democratic state of Israel. And you have Islamists who can't accept democracy, who want to destroy it on the one side. And on the other side, you have sort of the so-called, and I don't think they really are, but so-called liberal extremists who are also attacking Israel. And there's sort of a red-green alliance, the extreme left and the extreme green. And that's been operating at the intellectual level, the political level, for decades, and this is the sort of the spreading of contemporary anti-Semitism. And I think now we also have the emergence of the extreme right as well in Europe and in North America as well, which is beginning to also play a factor on the scene of anti-Semitism.
So how I don't know how to really word this, but in contemporary anti-Semitism, why is it that the Jewish people are always looped into almost the cornerstone of this new hatred, I guess you call it?
Yeah, why are always they're like the lightning rod for
hate.
Yeah,
and then, it just spreads out from there. Why is that?
So that's a great question. And the honest answer is, I really don't know, to be honest. I mean, you know, you can explain it from maybe a psychological perspective or an economic perspective or a political perspective. Maybe there's a metaphysical reason for it as well. I think it's like peeling an onion.
Right.
Sure.
Jews are sort of on the receiving end of sort of utopian movements that want to revolutionize and change the world. And it's interesting, yeah. But once again, you're right that the Jews are sort of, in this case, Israel's right in the middle. They're at the front line of a global war or a jihad against the West, and they're right in the middle of it, confronting it, I think, fighting for democratic, basic democratic values and values of decency and inclusion of all people.
Well, and it's,
they're fighting.
It's crazy because they're 1/19th the size of California. I mean, it isn't like they're controlling half the landmass on the earth.
Yeah.
I mean,
1/19th the size of California, and they're affecting global.
It's a little itty bitty place, and it's like, how hard would it be for all the people that surround them to just leave them alone?
Right.
I mean, it almost defies logic.
It's a profound question, and I think that's the question, and I think that's the challenge, actually, for Muslims in the region. And in a sense, I think Islam has a tradition of accepting the other and respecting the other. But I think Islam has been controlled now or hijacked by the Muslim Brotherhood and other offshoots of very radical, reactionary, narrow visions of what the world ought to be. And they can't accept the other. They can't accept women as being equal under the law. They can't accept Jews having self-determination on that space of land. And I think Israel, in a sense, poses a challenge to the Muslim community to live up to the best of its standards and to respect and to see the other, to accept the Jew as somebody equal to them. And it's a challenge for the geopolitical environment that we live in. And hopefully, you know, Muslims who are fighting for democracy and standing up to this brutal reactionary regime will get support from the West and usher in an era of more acceptance. But I think, in a sense, it's a challenge to them.
Because this is a whole new, if you think about it, just from a time standpoint, the first time it was on, the modern era radar was really, with Hitler and World War II and all that, and in Europe. Well, that generation of people is basically gone. So all of this is being carried out by a completely different generation of people who ostensibly should be a lot more educated. And oddly enough, if the Jewish population did the things or were the things, I guess if they really embodied all the things that these people ascribe to them, they would have imploded decades ago. You know? I mean, you can't be really bad and really all these things and be successful. And Israel has been extremely successful. And when you look at the fact that they're still there, huddled in among all these giant countries that hate them with lots of people in them, it's kind of a marvel.
Yeah, it is. It is. And what's interesting, too, you spoke about Nazi anti-Semitism. What's interesting is the Muslim Brotherhood, about 100 years ago, when they were created about 100 years ago in Egypt, and they actually take European anti-Semitism into the Middle East for the first time. And they actually take a lot of the political ideology and rhetoric of the Nazis into their core of their ideology. It's not the extreme wing or the military wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's mainstream in their ideology. They basically took the notion of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a forged document, purporting to talk about how Jews are controlling the world and all these sort of horrific, anti-Semitic, irrational, kind of pathetic lies and tropes, which justified not only the removal of Jews from European society, but actually justified the extermination of them during the Holocaust. The Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam takes this as a mainstream part of their ideology.
And what is it called again?
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yeah. It's funny, I was going to ask you about that because I forgot to bring my notes from that talk, and I thought, what was that called again?
Yeah. So it's a forged document that emerges in France or in Russia in the 1870s. And as Elie Wiesel said, and I think the most important thing about different forms of hatred is that the Holocaust did not begin with the crematoriums and the railroad tracks to the extermination camps. It began with words and ideas. And the words and ideas of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a forged document that purports to show how Jews were conspiring to take over the world.
Is that where the taking over the world thing comes from? Because
yes,
that's always a thread, and I'm thinking, from a numeric standpoint, you'd have to be kind of a dunce to believe that, but hang on one second. We'll be right back. Our guest is Charles Asher Small. We hope you will join us online at wethepeopleradio.us and send this program to friends who need the information. We'll be right back. So let's not leave this Protocols of the Elders of Zion, Dr. Small, because honestly, I'm willing to put money down that 90%, it's probably higher, of people have never heard of that and have no idea right. that there actually is a beginning to all this stuff. Was it a book, a pamphlet? What is it? And who wrote it?
Yes, so basically it's a forged document that emerges in France in the 1870s or 80s. Or Russia, depending, there's different historical understandings of where this emerged from. But it was this lie that actually, in the sort of the moment in Europe after emancipation and enlightenment and the emancipation of Jews, they became citizens of Europe for the first time in the late 1800s in Germany and in France. And there was sort of this backlash to the inclusion of Jews for the first time in Europe as citizens. And this lie kind of fed into this sort of, this sort of backlash against including Jews into European society. And it began to have traction. And as Elie Wiesel said, and I think it's very important, that the Holocaust, the extermination of European Jews, didn't begin with the railroad tracks and the crematoriums. It began with words and ideas. And the words of and ideas of the Protocols is now mainstream in many Middle Eastern countries, in Iran, in Egypt, in countries, in their music, in their culture, among their intellectuals. So the complete demonization of the Jewish people is mainstream. And those ideas that led to not only the extermination of 6 million Jews in Europe, but the decimation of Europe as a whole. The,
sure.
80 million people being killed, the entire infrastructure of Europe being decimated. That once this, as Elie Wiesel said, once this idea begins to gain traction, it begins with Jews, but it never ends with Jews. And you can look at Syria, you can look at Iraq, and you can see those reactionary movements are talking about the Jews and the Zionists and the Israelis. On the one hand, but just like the Nazis, on the other hand, they're killing their own brothers and sisters. They're destroying progressive democratic institutions in their society. And in the name of the concern about the Jew and the Israeli, they're killing their own people by large, large numbers. 15 million refugees from Syria, 1 million people being killed at the hands of Sunni and Shiite extremists who buy into this ideology of hatred.
And what's it? What is it? So it says that. Is it a long document? A short document? Is it a list? I mean, how did people get this?
It became popular among so-called intellectuals in Nazi Europe, Nazi
sure.
Germany, and the demonization of the other, the demonization of a so-called race that was impure, and the threat that this so-called group of people had to the mainstream of society became more and more acceptable at a time of economic and social pressures.
Okay.
And I think if anything, if we can learn from society, if we can learn from our history, is that we have to be very careful when we start demonizing groups of people, any groups of people. And this is not just a question of defending the groups of people's rights, but it's also, in my view, we have to see this as an attack on democratic principles. So once we start demonizing groups or subjugating groups or segregating groups or justifying all sorts of tropes and mysterious powers or innate characteristics and qualities of a group of people, it's an attack on who we are as a democracy.
I think that's a really important thing to point out, and it's also really important to underscore that came that it was promoted heavily through the intellectual elites. Because I mean, from the outside looking in, I obviously don't spend any time at any of the places that you do, but it seems like in our colleges and universities, especially in the United States, anti-Semitism seems to be alive and well.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, that's true, and it's fascinating. There's an assumption, or I grew up with an assumption that academics and intellectuals and professors and universities was a space to explore ideas, and it was an institution that defended and promoted democratic principles. But you're right. I think today in the United States and in other countries, universities have become the purveyors, the cutting-edge purveyors, and the justifiers of anti-Semitism and of reactionary anti-democratic politics. And it's extraordinary. And we can learn the lesson, actually, from Nazi Europe and Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and that the university was the only institution in Germany, and this to me is remarkable, that the university was the only institution in Germany that voluntarily turned over its Jews and replaced them as professors. There's no other institution, the unions, the police, the army, never turned over voluntarily their fellow Jews. But the professors were quick to kick the Jews out of the university and take their jobs.
No kidding. So history does repeat itself a little bit there.
Yeah, so this tradition, yes, seems to be repeating itself. And I would argue that, you know, education is the cornerstone of a democratic society, and universities are perhaps the most important institution in our society because we train and we teach our future generation of leaders, you know, in all spheres of society, to coming up through the system, through the university, to enter into society. And it's there that I think Jewish students are experiencing anti-Semitism at much higher rates than other parts of society. So there's an age gap. Jewish Americans under 25 are experiencing anti-Semitism at much higher rates than older Jewish people in the United States. And there were studies that were done. Barry Cosman of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, just did a study showing that Jewish students in the United States experience or have witnessed an anti-Semitic act in the last 6 months at much higher rates than women or female students experience sexism, and African Americans experience or witness racism. So the Jews experiencing hatred, experiencing it at almost four times the rate of other minorities or women.
And I know we're all shocked that we didn't hear any of this in the media.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. As far as the colleges, you know, the colleges used to be a place for, you know, free speech and ideas. But somehow we have thrown all that in the wastebasket. And now if you have an original thought or a thought that goes against
you're a blasphemer.
The grain, yeah, you can't do that at universities anymore.
Back in the day, since you've studied this extensively, did they have the demonizing and the silencing at that time like we're seeing it now? Was that also a characteristic? Because I'm assuming it's not new.
Right. No, I don't. I think it's changing, and it's changing rapidly. So, you know, I was a student in the 1980s and 90s, and you know, the extreme left and some extreme Islamists were kind of on the periphery of campuses, and there were some critical courses on Middle East politics and history and society that was there, but it was very much, I think, at the margins.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to do my doctorate degree, and I taught in England in the 1990s, and in Europe, these issues were much more advanced, and I mean, the anti-Semitism as part of education in Europe was much stronger than in North America, and it's almost like a wave that kind of swept over North America. I think it entered Canada in a big way, I'd say, about 15 to 20 years ago, and now we see it entering the United States in the last decade or so, and it's become a very powerful force. Not just on the university campuses where you have people like Students for Justice in Palestine and the Muslim Student Association, which are essentially funded and fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood in this country. So you have campus politics that are becoming kind of more contentious with these groups being more active and funded on our college campuses. So you have these sort of the extreme green, the radical Muslims on our campus, and you have the sort of progressive or the postmodern radical left in the classroom. So we're getting it from the radical left in the classroom, and we're getting it on campus from the Islamists. And there's sort of this red-green alliance that is there on university campuses, and it's making life difficult for Jewish American students to go to school.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, the campuses, I think, are in somewhat a reflection of our own government. I mean, we have this in our own, you know, we have people in our Congress that are
You try to do a resolution on anti-Semitism, and it turns into a pro-Muslim thing.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that work out?
It's
we've got to take a really quick break before we delve into that topic, but thank goodness we have tons of time, because Dr. Charles Usher-Schmall is our hostage for the whole show, so we get to pick his brain for a long time. I'm kind of excited about it. We will be right back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We really appreciate it. Because, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, not long enough. This is way too, there's just too much stuff
to talk about.
You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest, Dr. Charles Usher-Schmall. You're listening to We the People. We hope that you will send this program out to pretty much everybody you know. We're discussing contemporary anti-Semitism, and it's a topic I think we don't discuss much because most of us don't understand it well enough, really. We know that when we hear things, you hear some of this stuff like Bill had mentioned right before the break in our from some of the congressional representatives that have been elected by these extremists, and you hear the things they say, it's like, that is not, not going to fly.
It happened because of our, I think a lot of it comes from our colleges, and those people get the voting age, and then all of a sudden you start showing up in
the bad part is though, regular people listen to that and think, well, nobody's going to believe that. That's ridiculous.
Well, they are believing
But that's
it.
What happened before.
Yeah.
Nobody thought they would really do it, and they did.
Yeah.
So,
Dr. Small, I don't want to leave this subject, but I could you explain the difference between Zionists, Jews, and Israelis?
The whole Zion thing gets thrown around all the time, and it's good and bad, depending on who you hear it from. Yeah, smartness up there.
When you say the Zion thing, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, they throw this around all the time. You know, we're anti-Zionists, we're Zionists, and it's kind of like, I think people need to know, I don't know, let's just make it easy, who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Right.
Like, what does that mean in context?
So I think, so to me, and I think to most people, Zionism was a movement of the Jewish people, a Jewish liberation movement to take back our homeland. And, you know, everyone who reads the Old Testament or the Torah or the New Testament or even the Quran, if people read history and look at the region, everybody knows that the Jewish people's home is from that region. It's from Israel.
Right.
And after thousands of years of exile, of being treated as third and fourth class citizens in exile, and leading up to, I guess, the reaction to Jewish emancipation in Europe and to World War I and World War II, and the subjugation of the Jewish people in Europe and also in the Middle East and in Arab countries, the Jewish world said enough, and we had an opportunity to take back our homeland. And that's what Zionism is, the liberation of the Jewish land for the Jewish people and to have self-determination in our homeland. And our self-determination was reestablished in 1947, 1948, and that, to me, that's what it means to be a Zionist. And so as a Jewish person who prays three times a day facing Israel, facing Jerusalem, the fact that in my lifetime, after so many years of exile, that my people have self-determination in that part of the world, to me is miraculous, and it's a wonderful thing. It's the fulfillment of the Zionist movement. So that's Zionism, the liberation of the Jewish land.
Okay, so on the flip side, how did they paint this as I mean, it's such a, I don't know, I guess it sounds trivial to say, but it's such a small piece of land.
Right.
It's an important piece, I get that, but it's a relatively small area. Why the massive heartburn?
I think because it's a democracy in the middle of a region.
But besides that, where do they expect you to go? Is there an alternative?
Right.
You should have gone over here instead of over there. Is there any of, because I've never heard that.
Right. So I think it comes from the fact that radical Islam, not Islam and not Muslims, but political Islam, as a reactionary social movement, has taken strides and has received support and power throughout the region and in the West. But as a footnote, that's very important because I think the West has cooperated with the Muslim Brotherhood and radical Islamists for decades, and that's a whole other interesting issue.
Well, I mean, but care now is an integral part of our society and considered by a lot of people to be a legitimate organization,
right?
Which is crazy.
Yeah. So on the one hand, the radical, so political Islam can't accept the self-determination of anybody else other than a practicing Muslim on what they consider to be so-called Islamic land. So the Jews are the only people in that region to have self-determination who are not Muslim and have imposed democratic principles on their society. And political Islam is opposed to democracy. They're opposed to having any influence from the outside world, including the West, the United States, Europe, in their caliphate. And for them, it's unacceptable to have the Jewish people there. And I think as a result of oil and money and power, a lot of these sort of reactionary political Islamists have been influencing and paying money to universities, have been entering into all kinds of strategic alliances with Western countries. And in a sense, the Muslim Brotherhood has a long history of chapters. Actually, a lot of their exiled intellectuals from Egypt were at American universities where they helped to establish groups like the Muslim Student Society 70 years ago. And the Muslim Student Society and the Students for Justice in Palestine, funded in part by the Muslim Brotherhood, are, you know, carrying out on campuses their worldview. So that's happening. And then you can go back to European governments, Canadian governments, American administrations who have worked with these radical groups as well. And, you know, President Obama, for example, we know the Cairo speech was a very, I think, profound moment where he invited the Muslim Brotherhood to be honored guest of his Cairo speech, his first foreign speech outlining his foreign policy in Cairo. And that said a lot. That said a lot. So yeah. That gave a message to the Muslim Brotherhood. He also engaged, in quotations, the Iranian revolutionary regime. And these are all movements that want to exterminate the Jews. They see Jews as animals. They want to subjugate women. They want to subjugate religious minorities, and yet Western governments work with them. Oxford University's Islamic Society, Islamic Studies Center at Oxford University, one of the most prestigious universities in the world, started none other than Yosef Kaladawi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. So you have the British establishment and even the American establishment working with these anti-democratic, anti-American, anti-Semitic movements.
Are there any Muslim organizations that you're aware of that are accepting of the Jewish nation and the Jewish people?
Anybody who has any horsepower?
Yeah, so there definitely are. I think there are Muslims in this country and mosques in this country and in Western countries and in the Middle East and other parts of the world that try to reach out to the other, that try to reach out to the Jewish community, to other communities, to try to instill democratic principles in their congregants, to understand that living in a democratic country, you're entitled to religious freedom and you're entitled to go to your place of worship and worship as you wish, but that we are participating in a society with that every citizen has rights, that every citizen has the right to be equal under one law, and that there's certain ideas and practices that are not compatible to radical Islam in the United States or in other Western democracies. So I think there are. We work with groups in Europe like the Quilliam Foundation. These are Muslim intellectuals who are fighting fiercely for democratic principles and fighting against anti-Semitism and the demonization of Jews and others. So there's some great people and great movements doing work in this field, and they should be supported and helped and, I think, sought out and worked with.
I would imagine that groups like that in the Middle East are probably in some sort of danger.
Few and far between?
By voicing their accepting of Israel. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think
they're not popular. They're not the cool kids.
Right. I think they're really brave, and there are people working to the acceptance of Israel. And I think that there's some shifts in the region, too, which are really interesting. I think as Iran, or the Iranian revolutionary regime of Iran, threatens not only Israel, but its other neighbors in the region, that there's sort of this organic, I'd say, possibility of an alliance emerging with Israel and Sunni nations who are worried about the expansive and brutal nature of the Iranian revolutionary regime.
That's so kind of nice. It's a little bright spot.
Pardon me?
It's a little bright spot on the horizon.
There is, yes. There's more cooperation at that level, and hopefully that it can be a long-term phenomenon.
Do you take much pushback at Oxford, since they do have this heavy presence of Muslim Brotherhood there?
So it's an interesting story. I can tell you, the story quickly, but I did my PhD at Oxford.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to walk you into the corner and then leave you standing there alone.
Okay, no problem.
We're going to get cut off by the news here shortly, but when we come back, I do want to hear that, because I am curious how this happens on a college campus, because what happens on a college campus also happens in society. I mean, how do you share the space?
Yeah.
You know, the Muslim Brotherhood, and you guys are having a seminar about how those guys are oppressing everyone and being anti-Semites. I'm dying to know. We will be right back with our guest, Dr. Charles Asher Small. He is the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. You can find him at isgap.org.
You got .org.
Just a nabbit right there. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.